is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Thursday, May 7th, 2020. Taylor Schwenk is producing from his home studio in Connecticut. I'm Buster Olney. I'm working from my home studio just north of New York City. We're going to be talking with Jim Leland about his time as manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Marlins and the Rockies and the Detroit Tigers. And he's got some great observations about Barry Bonds and about his good friend Al Kaline and the last dinner that they shared together. A couple of notes before that. The coronavirus pandemic has slowed contract talks between Javier Baez and the Cubs. Baez is under team control through 2021. He told ESPN that the Cubs and his representatives had what he characterized as multiple, quote-unquote, really good conversations about a long-term contract extension during the spring. But obviously, the context for those talks and just about everything else has very much changed. Jeff Passan reports, Major League Baseball expects to offer a return-to-play proposal to the Player Association within a week as teams have begun to encourage players to prepare for a second spring training that could begin in mid-June and a season that could start in early July. Although a significant number of hurdles remain and some industry leaders believe June and July return dates are overly optimistic, ownership's approval of a plan and dialogue about specifics with the union would mark two vital steps toward baseball's return from a season so far delayed 6 weeks by the pandemic. I had one influential source tell me a couple days ago that last week he was optimistic there would be a resumption of the season, and this week he is less optimistic because of all of the issues that have to be resolved. Jeff went on to report scouting directors are waiting on the official word, but have told ESPN that they expect the MLB draft in June to be five rounds. That's what I've heard, too, instead of the standard 40. Further, though most teams have guaranteed employees pay through the end of May, the delay of baseball beyond July would precipitate a wave of furloughs and layoffs, according to sources. And by the way, that June date for the draft, some folks in the industry believe that as soon as that is over, that you will see furloughs of a lot of scouts. Now, before we get to Jim Leland and to Marley Rivera, we're going to promote our own podcast. Be sure to tune in tomorrow as we finally play the Terry Francona interview we've had in the vault for a few weeks. Tito is going to be telling stories about his days as coach of the Birmingham, manager of the Birmingham Barons, when a guy named Michael Jordan was on his squad. Once you're done listening, watch episodes 7 and 8 of The Last Dance Sunday on ESPN, presented by State Farm and AT&T. The podcast will be a good appetizer as the documentary is going to touch on Michael's baseball playing days. We hope that you're as excited as we are. Marley Rivera covers baseball for ESPN. And Marley, earlier this week on ESPN.com, an interview that you did with Tony Clark, the head of the Players Association, was posted. People can find it there. What was your biggest takeaway from your conversation with Tony?
I was a little bit surprised, Buster, in that conversation, because obviously we have seen all the quote-unquote proposals that have been out there, you know, the Arizona plan, the Florida plan, you know, even, you know, Dallas has been included in these. And when I asked Tony straight out which one of these plans had the better possibility, which I believe is one of the questions that you suggested, because obviously all of us at ESPN talk about these kind of Q&As, he said, there isn't a proposal on my desk. And that was surprising to me. I always thought that all these proposals that were being talked about, that all of these had been run by the Players Association. Now we have learned that Major League Baseball is getting a proposal together, and it should be at Tony's desk in the upcoming days. But that was the most interesting thing, Buster, that the Players Association wasn't that involved in those talks.
Marley, earlier today I did a radio interview and I was asked sort of about the context of, you know, that the proposal that Major League Baseball is going to put forward to the players. They said, look, for me, based on what I've heard from agents and club executives, Major League Baseball officials, that would be like the first batter stepping into the box for the very first inning, the top of the first in terms of the process. What's your read on it?
That's exactly it, Buster. And that's when I mentioned that I was surprised, it's exactly that. This is the very beginning. Now, let's look at the positive. The beginning is happening, right? And we are in May. And obviously, you and I have heard that they are looking at late July as an option, mid-July as an option. So right now, we're thinking of a three-week spring break. And obviously, this all depends on what happens with this terrible pandemic. And, you know, I live in New York City, and I'm seeing it firsthand that this is nowhere near controlled at this point. But the good part is that you're right. The batter is up and first pitch is coming. But we thought first pitch had been out there a while ago.
Yeah, exactly. Two of the biggest issues that they're going to have to deal with in negotiations between Major League Baseball and the Players Association. One is the salary rollbacks that the Major League Baseball teams are going to be looking for. You know, I heard actually this week that on the management side, there's actually one team that's already instructed their front office for 2021 to cut payroll. So that's the mindset on that side. And the other thing, too, is the question of liability. You know, if a player walks into a stadium, he gets a coronavirus, he gets sick, who's actually responsible for that? What did you learn in your conversation with Tony about those two issues, about salary rollbacks and about liability?
In terms of salary rollbacks, Tony was very clear that all the conversations, and this is, I'm quoting, you know, Union Chief Tony Clark, that everything that we're going to talk about in terms of salary is done. And that the focus right now, he said, we have an agreement. Obviously, that agreement can be adjusted, right? So that's the one thing that Tony said about salary. And the one thing that he stressed constantly, he said, this is all about player safety. And the liability is an issue, and it's something that they're discussing. And not only for the players, Buster, for third parties too, right? People who get infected with the coronavirus because a particular team opens up for business, right? So it's not only about the players. The liability is much wider than that. And the focus on player health and safety, number one for the union. That was the one thing that Tony said. That is the one thing that we care about, that Major League Baseball should care about. And until they resolve that, I mean, he didn't say it flat out, but he implied that the membership would not agree to anything that would not guarantee player safety.
Oh. And again, you can read Marley's story on ESPN.com. In a moment, we're going to be talking with Jim Leland, the longtime manager of the Detroit Tigers, the Pirates, and other teams. And one of the players I intend to ask him about, Miguel Cabrera, who someday will make a speech at Cooperstown. I don't think it's going to be the longest speech ever made in Cooperstown, Marley, but it's going to be made. And I feel, you know, look, you feel bad for everybody affected by this in any walk of life. But, I've thought of Miguel Cabrera, who, when I saw him in spring training, he was in tremendous shape. And it looked like, okay, he has a chance to bounce back from last year. He just turned 37 in April, 2,815 hits. What do you got on Miggy Cabrera?
Well, Miggy is one of my favorites, and you said it. You know, he doesn't have to speak long, but he will certainly be memorable. And I'll tell you, this is all you need to know about the kind of person Miguel Cabrera is. I broke my leg a couple of years ago, and I happened to be walking by Detroit Airport, kind of hobbling with my suitcase, and I was in a connecting flight, and all of a sudden someone comes from behind me and just grabs my suitcase. And I turn around to obviously to yell at whoever this person is, and it's Miguel Cabrera, and he looks at me and he goes, "Do you need some help?" And I thought it was one of those moments that shows who Miggy is. That is, this is one of the most humble superstars in Major League Baseball. And when you said that, Buster, about the kind of guys that this affects, it also reminded me of Felix Hernandez, who is also looking for another chance, who is really supposed to make, you know, that Braves rotation. And isn't that same position of not knowing whether he's going to have a chance? And you said it, Miggy, everyone is always criticizing that Cabrera has all these years left in his contract. And he came back with a healthy back, you know, kind of trying to be an everyday player again, and now we don't know what we're going to get.
Yeah, we'll see. That's a great story. I'd never heard that. You never told me that story before. That's awesome. All right, Marley, thanks for doing this.
Of course. Thank you, Buster. You guys have a good day. Thanks, Taylor.
It's time to make the call. Call to the legend on Baseball Tonight.
Jim Leland managed 22 years in the big league, 1,769 wins, a World Series title with the Marlins in 1997, two American League championships with the Detroit Tigers. Jim, how you doing? Thanks for helping to distract us.
Well, not a problem. I'm glad to be with you and, you know, doing like everybody else, just kind of following the letter of the law. And, you know, hopefully things are going to turn around here and people are going to get well. We're going to quit losing lives and at some point, maybe even get back to baseball. But I think that's not the most important thing right now, obviously.
Absolutely. Now, I've always thought that a common denominator among the best managers is, and it sounds simple, but I think it's absolutely true, is that they like people. They have a great appreciation for people. And you were always one of those. And let me give you an example of that. This is a sound from Game 5 Division Series against the Yankees, 2011. Give a listen.
Ball at third base. But Leland says he likes him in there for this. His bat, especially at Yankee Stadium. And Don Kelly answers the call from his manager. 1-0 Tigers as Don Kelly goes deep.
Oh, when we see this pitch on the replay, it's a curveball over the middle of the zone. The first game that Nova pitched, he threw primarily fastballs in that first inning.
Well, it's interesting talking to Jim Leland. You can see that breaking ball John was talking about. He talked about his fifth different lineup that, Brian, you brought up, and he said he liked Kelly.
Yeah, and Jim, that sound from TBS, Brian Anderson and Ron Darling and John Smoltz. But I never forget your reaction that day after you guys won that game and how happy you were for Don Kelly. What do you remember about that?
Well, I remember. I thought he was actually – I really thought he was a good matchup for Nova, to be honest with you. I know David Dombrowski wasn't quite sure, I think, when I played him and hit him second. But I just felt like he was a good matchup for Nova. And I felt, you know, with the short porch there in Yankee Stadium, you know, I thought, I had a feeling that, you know, he might do something big for us. I didn't know it was going to be a home run, but I thought he had a chance to have a decent game. And, of course, you know – there's not a better guy than Donnie Kelly. He's a new bench coach of the Pittsburgh Pirates and coming home out of Pittsburgh. And, you know, he's just one of those guys that everybody loves. He's a good guy. And he was a perfect extra player because he never complained. He knew he wasn't going to play a lot, but never complained. Was always ready to do it. And was actually a really good defensive outfielder. So he was a better player, I think, than people gave him credit for. He didn't hit the high fastball very good, but he was actually a better player, Buster, I think, than people thought he was. And he was a perfect fit. You know, on a nice team, a good team where he had some stars, but, you know, slipped this guy in there once in a while, and he, you know, he provided some dividends for us.
You always worked hard at connecting with players. When I'd be in the Detroit clubhouse, you'd swing through. You always seemed to have something going with each one of the guys there. Tell me about that, you know, how you did that.
Well, I just think that, you know, you have to have the team concept, obviously. You have to have some team rules, but, you know, how you get everybody to abide by those rules could be different. You know, people are different as individuals. And I always try to make it a point during batting practice to walk around out in the outfield and talk to everybody, see how they're doing, check the family, you know, just different things to let them know that you care about them and there's something besides baseball, you know. And I always wanted to kind of mix with them to get an idea. You know, you could always tell when somebody saw you coming if they were mad at you because they weren't playing enough or something, but you ironed it out, you know. And the other thing I did was – I very rarely, I'm not saying I didn't do it, but I very rarely ever had a closed door meeting with a player because I did it during the outfield in batting practice. In other words, if we had a problem, the player and myself had a problem, I would go out during batting practice and I would eventually get to him and we would discuss, you know, whatever the problem was, because I felt like if you close the door, you know, it sends a message to the media. It sends a message to the other players. It's embarrassing for the player. His peers know what's going on. The media knows what's going on. So I tried to do it a little bit different so the player was never embarrassed. And yet you could go out in the outfield. People didn't know whether you were telling a joke or, you know, getting on each other or what it was. So I don't know. You just learn things over the years, little knacks that you think are advantageous to you as a manager. And you're right, to be honest with you. I mean, strategy is one thing. Who knows strategy? I mean, manager has options. And the manager, you always try to pick what you think is your best option to win the game. But strategy is going to be questionable with anybody. So it's dealing with people and getting them to play hard for you and getting to play for you. And then, you know, hopefully you're making the right move during the game.
Once the game started, what was your favorite part about managing in a game?
Well, I love the strategy. I really did. And it's a funny game because it's no two games are the same. And that's why some of the new stuff that they have now with the analytics and all that stuff, there's a lot of truth to that stuff over the entire course of the season with all the teams involved. But each game is different. So what you might have to do to win that particular game that night is the most important thing. And it might be contrary to something that the analytics said. Those people might not believe that. But overall, those percentages might be right. But your percentage to win this game, this particular game this night, could be totally different. It could be on the other side of the percentage swing. So you have to be careful with that. And I loved it. I loved the preparation. You know, we had all that information going in, and when you see things unfold, it was always a, you know, it was always a fun thing to see. I think probably the most important thing is handling your bullpen. I don't think there's any question about that. I think if you got good starters and a bad bullpen, you can leave your starter in too long. And if you got good starters and a good bullpen, you can take your starter out too quick. So it was a fun thing. And that's the most fun time of your day or evening is when the game starts.
Trevor Hoffman, of course, Hall of Fame closer, when he would blow a save, he would sit in the dugout after the game for about 10 minutes and just process what happened that night. And then he would go back into the clubhouse, and his mental thinking was, once I walk back into the clubhouse, I've washed that off of me and I'm moving forward. For you as a manager, how difficult were dealing with tough losses?
Well, I think that's a great point, because I think different people handle it differently. I did it a little bit different than that. I went in to the clubhouse after the game, and I stayed till after everybody left, and I thought about it, and Dean Lamont might stay with me for most of that time, but I think about it, discuss it. You usually have, you know, one guy, in my case, it was Dean Lamont, where you could bounce things off of. You say, you know, I mugged this game. I should have done this. I should have done that. What do you think? And you talk about it. But I always waited till I knew that I was ready to turn the page before I left the clubhouse. Sometimes I would sit in the clubhouse and watch the late game out on the West Coast till 1:15 or so in the morning before I went home. But once I went home, it was over with, and the next day was a new chapter.
I'll always think of Tony La Russa as the greatest manager in the history of baseball. He's obviously a friend of yours. You know him well. What separated him as a manager in your eyes?
I think the number one thing, I coached for Tony for 4 years. I think Tony was the best at, you know, you can manage three or four games in a row where there's really not a lot to do. You know, if your club's rolling good and things are falling right, there's not a lot of major decisions sometimes, but you can't manage like that. You have to stay on top of it in case that little surprise comes up. You have to be ready for it. And I never saw Tony La Russa surprised. I mean, I saw him when the White Sox were going good. I think we won 98 games or 99 games in 83, something like that. But, you know, there was a lot of games where everything was smooth, went well. But if something come up, he never missed it. And I think that's really the key to being a good manager. You cannot get lulled to sleep, and you have to be prepared for anything. And to be honest with you, I never really worried about the manager in the other dugout or his players. I worried about my players. And that's what I did. And I'll give you a silly for instance. I mean, everybody and their brother knew that if the Yankees had a one-run lead going into the ninth inning, sometimes eighth inning, that you were going to see Mariano Rivera. There's no secrets to what the other manager is going to do in most cases. So I tried to concentrate on having my players ready and to concentrate on putting my player in the best situation to succeed.
What's the biggest change in the position of manager in recent years in your eyes? You mentioned the analytics.
Well, there's more people involved. I mean, I think there's more people that want to give you more information. And I think that, you know, I get upset when people call me old school. I'm old, but I'm not old school, believe me. I've never met a manager yet that didn't want any information that would help him win a game. But I didn't want a bunch of idle reading material. You don't have time to read a book during a game. Things happen fast. And people, I think sometimes those people don't understand that. When you're in the dugout, you know, you got a 3-run lead and all of a sudden, you know, a walk, a hit batsman, and a blast, the game's tied. So it's a very fast pace down there where the analytical stuff, you sit, it's drawn out, and you think it out, and you prepare, and you look at the percentages and all this stuff. But you don't really have time to take a test when a major league game is going on. I mean, this stuff, these guys are really good, and things happen fast. So I think that they've given you more information, more people are involved. I think, from what I understand, I don't know this to be a fact. They say that some teams suggest lineups all the time to the manager. Whether that's true or not, I really don't know that. But I will make this point along those lines to the people that think I'm old school. Every day, I mean, for the most part, you have your certain players that are going to play every day. You know that. So there's not a lot of secret to that when they keep talking about these lineups and stuff. You know for the most part where people – but I talk to Dave Dombrowski every day. I talk to my coaches every day if there was a situation, like a Donnie Kelly situation or a Marcus Timm. Hey, I got a choice tonight between this guy, that guy. What do you guys think? I discuss that all the time. Nobody has all the answers. But I think that, in my opinion, if the manager doesn't know his players better than anyone else, he probably shouldn't be the manager. So I think that I like that information and I respect it. I think there's more of it in today's game. I think some of it's very valuable. I think some of it's eyewash, to be honest with you. But I think there's some stuff out there. And by way of the computer, as we all know, you get your information quicker. I mean, it took a little while to get it when I first started managing. But then, you know, later on, you got the computer, you got the printouts, you got the matchups, you got the percentages. You know, you know when to give a guy a day off. You look at something and, you know, this guy, he's one of my better players. He needs a day off, but I'm going to pick the spot 3 days from now because that's the one guy he doesn't hit very well. So I'll give him a day off that day. You know what I mean? There's a lot goes into this. But I think people really need to let the managers manage.
Terry Francona has a great relationship with the Cleveland front office. He told me that there are times when the front office will come to him with an idea, a concept. You know, you should play this guy more. You should use this guy this way or that sort of thing. And Terry's feeling is there's sometimes when you have, for lack of a better way to describe it, a political situation or you have a player who's in a certain state of mind. And so he will say, I hear you. Give me some time to work to it in terms of dealing with the player. What you mentioned, Dave Dombrowski, you worked with for years. When you guys had differences of opinion, how would you work through that?
The lineup was always mine. Dave was great. I'd ask him for suggestions, but never one time did he come down and say, hey, you have to play this guy. You can't play that guy. That never happened. I mean, we would discuss things, and ultimately he would always tell me, hey, you're the manager. It's your lineup. But I think when you say that, and I think Tito's right, I think you listen to people. Now, you know, it all depends who's coming down with the information. I mean, you know, that has something to do with it too. But I think, like, personally today, even yet today, I went in and listened to the analytical's 4-hour seminar from our organization. It's very interesting. I think there's something to some of it. I don't think there's any question about it. And I think you're always open to suggestions. But once again, you got to be careful. All of a sudden, you know, if you're not going to play a player and you slept on it and you didn't get that word to the player, you got a veteran player and he comes in and sees he's not in the lineup. You know, I always made it a point to try to tell them the night before if they were going to have a day off or 2 days before if they were going to have a day off. And if there was ever a surprise during those times, I would sit there after a tough loss or something. I might even call them on his way home and say, you know what, I'm thinking seriously, I don't want you to be shocked, but I'm thinking seriously, maybe give you tomorrow off or change the lineup a little bit tomorrow. I think, so a manager, there's much more to do than people think. And it's a lot more difficult, I believe. The stuff that they think that anybody can manage, put a bunch of numbers together and anybody can manage, I don't buy that. I can tell you firsthand, the better your players, the better the analytics.
Yeah. You manage Hall of Fame caliber players, guys who presumably are going to make speeches in Cooperstown. I want to ask you about Miguel Cabrera. When was the first time he signed with the Marlins after you left that organization? The first time that you heard about him or saw him in person, and what were your first impressions?
Well, you knew this was a superstar in the making. I saw him with the Marlins. I think I believe he hit a home run off Roger Clemens in the World Series when he was 21 years old, maybe, or something like that. I'm not sure. 20 years old, maybe, possibly.
Yep.
But, and you could see that this was a star in the makings. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to be his manager for quite a while. And I actually was fortunate enough to be the manager when he won the Triple Crown. And I've never seen anything like that because, you know, guys like Miguel Cabrera, I think Joe Torre won the batting title 1 year. And guys like Joe and Miguel Cabrera, they never got any leg hits. I mean, those guys don't get infield hits because they didn't really run that good. So, I mean, it was legitimate, everything they did. And to watch that year that he put together to win the Triple Crown, I mean, the first time since Yastrzemski in 67, it was actually amazing. I've really never seen anything like it. And he was hitting balls out of the ballpark to right field, left field, like ping pong balls. I mean, it was amazing.
I would tell people that I thought that, you know, friends who are fans, I would say the coolest thing to watch about Miguel Cabrera to me was the pitch-to-pitch adjustments that he would make with his hands and his feet. Does anything jump out at you about that?
Well, there's no question that he's a real smart hitter. You know, there's a lot going on with the hitting today in the new world of hitting, which I'm not really sure about, to be honest with you. I don't know that much about it. But Miguel, and Maglio Ordonez that were together on the same team, they were both brilliant hitters. They had a great feel for what the pitcher was going to try to do to them. You're right, they would make adjustments. And you know what? Neither one of them, I think Maglio drove in 48 runs with singles one year. And he was not above taking a base hit to right field with two outs and a man on second. Miguel's kind of the same way, a little bit more now because the power's kind of diminished a little bit since all the injuries. But, you know, smart hitters, and I'm a big believer that the really good hitters, they pick up the ball quicker than the guys that don't hit so well. They see the ball out of the hand much quicker. And when Miguel was really good, he's starting to charge a little bit more now to catch up. But when he was really good, that ball come out of the hand and he would just spit on a slider down in a way that he knew was off the plate. Other guys were charging it, you know, and maybe swinging at it, the one in the dirt or something. But I really believe that the really good hitters, their vision, depth perception, everything, I think has to be better than most guys.
It's funny you say that, Jim. One time I was having a conversation with Tony Gwynn about his good friend Barry Bonds, who you managed in Pittsburgh. And Tony said to me, he said, I think Barry picks up the ball when it's at the pitcher's head or maybe even a little bit before that. And I said, Tony, how do you know that? He goes, because I see it the same way. What do you remember right about the first time you saw Barry Bonds?
Well, you know, he was kind of a young, brash guy when he first came up here. Oh, very talented. Once again, you saw the superstar in the making. This is the best player I ever managed. I mean, people have arguments. I don't get into all that. What happened, what didn't happen, I don't know. But, I mean, is Barry Bonds going to make the Hall of Fame? I don't know if he's going to make it, but Barry Bonds is definitely a Hall of Famer. And so, I mean, this guy was just, he could do everything. I never saw a better left fielder. His arm was not real strong. But Bill Verdon worked with him, and he got to the ball quicker. He was the best defensive player in left field that I've ever seen. And, you know, offensively, he could steal bases. He had power. And the power came a little later, obviously, than when I had him, although he did hit 30, I think, for me. But this guy was, you could just see, this guy was a true superstar. He's all-around the best player I ever managed, although Larry Walker is the best five-tool player I ever had. But Barry Bonds was the best player I ever had.
What was it like to manage Barry, who obviously had spent his whole life in baseball and been around clubhouses his whole life?
Well, I thought it was a piece of cake. I loved Barry Bonds. We're very good friends. You know, we had the one blow up that's famous. That's kind of embarrassing to me because I think it's kind of been a trademark, and that's embarrassing because it was just a misunderstanding and two guys that really liked each other. And Barry was one of those guys that was very interesting. And this goes back to managing, and this goes back to what you said earlier about handling people. Barry was the type of guy that if I would have made up to him and kissed his fanny and all this stuff, I don't think he would have liked me. So I always tried to leave him in doubt whether I really liked him or not. And I just kind of wanted to keep him guessing because if you oohed and aahed all over Barry, he just didn't like that. He wasn't that type of guy. He was a tough guy. He's got a great heart. He did a lot of things behind the scenes in Pittsburgh that nobody knew about, sent kids to college, paid for their education. I mean, this guy he was a different guy to the media. And I think it actually hurt him in 1990 when he won the MVP. I don't believe he went to the New York Writers' Dinner, and I think that was the start of people being upset with Barry. But if you really know Barry and get to know Barry, he's got a great heart. He's a very, very close friend of mine, and he always will be.
Justin Verlander, the first impressions that you had when you met him?
Well, you know, I saw him in spring training, and that's really a good story, to be honest with you. When I saw him in spring training, you know, you watch him throw like you do with the 8-packs. You know, everybody's on the 8-pack throwing, and you watch these guys, and, you obviously heard about him. He was the number one pick and, you know, all that stuff. So I remember when I took the job, I asked Dave Dombrowski, I said, you know, are you going to let me take the guys I want to take? He said, well, you know, within reason. I mean, Dave was the boss, and Dave had the right to give you the players. That, I felt, was the general manager's job, and once he gave them to you, then you managed them. Well, he said, within reason. Well, it wasn't long in the spring training. I said, you know, I want to take this guy and this guy. And it was Justin Verlander and Joel Zamaya. And I remember Dave at first said, well, you know, you don't know what they're going to do. And I said, well, you're right, I don't. But I know what the guys that we've had here for the last 5 years are going to do. We haven't finished 500 in Detroit for 13 seasons, and you lost 100 and some games 2 years ago. I said, I know what they're going to do. So I want to take a shot. I like talent. And he was all on board with it. Dave gave it the blessing, and we took Justin Verlander, and pretty much the rest is history.
Yeah, I was going to say, among players I've been around, I don't know. The first time I interviewed Justin, I asked him, you know, what his goal was. And typically you get, you know, have a good season, you know, hope we finish first. And he just looked me in the eye and said, I want to do everything I can to be in the Hall of Fame, which said a lot about his goal, how goal-oriented he is.
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't think anybody worked harder than him. I think that, you know, he was relentless on his work and everything and his preparation and everything. And I don't think there's any question about that. I think you're right. I think that was his goal from day one. And I think that goal is probably accomplished. I would hope so, certainly at some point. But, you know, he was just relentless. And he was, you know, they talk about how much he's changed since he got to Houston. He's a better pitcher and this and that. Well, I don't know about that. I mean, Justin Verlander won an MVP, Cy Young in Detroit, you know, so he was a little bit different because when he was really young, Buster, he just had overpowering stuff. A great curveball, really a good fastball, good changeup, didn't have the slider yet, but he was a little bit more of a wild stallion. There's no question about it. Now he's mastered that high fastball control. He's still got the other pitches. So he's pitching a little bit more and a little bit better, probably than he's not relying quite as much on stuff. But this guy's been a great pitcher from pretty much day one.
And last one for another Hall of Famer I want to ask you about is someone you got to know well in Detroit, and that would be Al Kaline, who passed away recently. I thought it was neat that when people talked about him after his passing, that most of what was talked about was what a great person he was.
Yeah, he was, you know, they called him Mr. Tiger. I called him Mr. Gentleman. I knew Al since 1963 when I signed with the Tigers, went spring training in 64. I think he had been there earlier, obviously. And I was in the minor leagues. But any time we went over to a big club and later on I'd throw batting practice in my career, I'd throw batting practice to him and stuff. He just treated you like you were a teammate, like you were one of the guys. And then, of course, getting the job, I spent a lot of time with him. He'd come in my office pretty much every day when I managed the Tigers when we were at home. And we became really, really close friends. In fact, two nights before he left spring training to come home this year, he asked me, he said, Jim, could you have dinner with me and Louise? And I said, absolutely. And we just had a great, great time. Went to dinner in Lakeland and sat and visited and talked and laughed. And I pretty much knew, to be honest with you, it was like this was kind of a way of saying goodbye because we got back to the hotel. He said, hey, Jim, give me a hug. He said, thanks for being my friend all these years. And I knew that it was, I felt like it was different. You know, it was like this was some kind of goodbye. It was kind of a weird feeling. I went back to my room and laid in bed. And I started thinking about it. I said, man, that didn't seem just right. You know, that sounded like a goodbye. And sure enough, it was.
Well, Jim, I appreciate you taking the time and, you know, telling us these great stories. I've always loved going into your office when you managed it and hearing your stories because you have such great insight into the game.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you for having me on, Buster, and good luck and stay healthy.
Here's Tim Kirchens, Daily Baseball Fix, about Bartolo Colon.
Hi, this is Tim Kirchen, and on this date in 2016, Bartolo Colon, age 42, became the oldest player ever to hit his first Major League homer, surpassing Randy Johnson, who was 40. Mets broadcaster Gary Cohen called it one of the greatest moments in baseball history. It really shouldn't have been that stunning. Colon hit home runs in BP all the time. He's got great feet. He can do the splits, and he's unbelievably strong. He can do reverse curls like this with 35-pound weights just about this easily. Yet it was stunning when he hit his two-run homer off of James Shields. Kevin Pawecki was on second base at the time, and he thought, oh, my gosh, he finally did it. Pawecki told me that when Colon got to home plate, he said he didn't say a word. He said he was stunned like the rest of us. He said, I just looked at him and said, are you kidding me? So the two get to the dugout, and there's nobody in the dugout. They're all down in the tunnel. And Pawecki told me then they all came shooting out of the tunnel. They all bear hugged Bartolo Colon. He said it was amazing. It was nuts.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Thursday. First one up, Donald Mobley at Donald Mobley writes in, what's the strangest or most unique promotional giveaway you've seen in Major League Baseball through the years?
Wow. You know, and it wasn't, I don't know if you'd call this unique, but because it's tied to the event that I covered, it's always stuck out with me. On the day that David Wells threw his perfect game, May 17th, 1998, it was Beanie Baby Giveaway Day at Yankee Stadium. And that day, it was a year before my daughter was born. And so, you know, typically when we are handed stuff at the ballpark as a reporter, I don't keep it. And I'll give it to like a kid that I know or something like that. So that's what I wound up doing with that thing. And then I heard like later in the summer, like those things were selling for hundreds of dollars on eBay. And so I've always remembered Beanie Baby Day, David Wells tied with his perfect game.
That's wild. The Beanie Baby craze. What a throwback there.
Yep.
Portland Maverick at the Battered Bees writes in, Buster, who was a quote-unquote junk pitcher you loved watching here in the Northwest? I saw a ton of Jamie Moyer starts with a low 80s fastball, an assortment of salad that frustrated the hell out of hitters. He won 269 games with over 2,400 strikeouts. Fun to watch. What about you?
I totally back you up on that, and I have a great Jamie Moyer story. He was on the 1995 Orioles, the team that I covered for the Baltimore Sun. He was 32 years old at the time. And he had had some struggles. And I remember the day that the Orioles cut him. It was, I want to say, in midseason. But I remember standing in front of Jamie's locker. And Jamie's a super nice guy. And he hadn't really accomplished that much in his career. Hadn't had any big years. And he was talking about how, you know, I feel like I've got some things that I've been working on that could really turn for me. And no kidding, in the back of my mind, the thought that was going through was, you know what, dude? It's just time to go home to the kids. It's just, you know, it's time to give it up. Now, obviously, would never say that to anyone. Who am I? But he went on and won like 260 games after that, you know, pitching into his late 40s with that great pitcher's arrogance, believing that hitters were big, dumb oxen that just needed to be exploited. And he did that a lot.
Good stuff. Last one for today. Jason Amico at Jason Amico writes in, what was your favorite moment of Tony Gwynn's career and why? I know you spent a great deal of time covering him, Buster, and you have a special fondness for Tony. I'm interested to hear this as well.
Yeah, and I got a lot of stories about him, but my favorite was from the 1995 All-Star game. He scored the game-winning run on a walk-off hit by Moises Alou. If I remember correctly, either Moises Alou or Fred McGriff. But either way, what I remember was, of course, you know, I was the beat writer covering the Padres for the San Diego Union. That was at 1994 All-Star game. I apologize. But, you know, Tony was, for me, was a must have. And so I went down into the clubhouse and he wasn't there. And he was, and I was starting to panic because my deadline was coming up and I'm thinking, oh my God, I got to get Tony. I got to get Tony. And I found him. And in classic Tony Gwynn fashion, he basically wrote my story. Because when he spoke and he talked about his journey around the bases, scoring the winning run, he talked anecdotally. It was like he narrated the whole thing. I saw the hit go into left center field, and I thought, if I can get to second before blah, blah, blah. He just had such a wonderful way of telling stories, and that was my game story. And the next year when I applied for a job at the Baltimore Sun, that was mentioned by the sports editor. Wow, that was a great game story. What I didn't tell him was, yeah, that was basically narrated by Tony Gwynn. It was like an oral history the way Tony told stories.
That's amazing. Tony got you the job with the Sun.
That's what I always thought. I always told people. I was so lucky to cover Tony as a young beat reporter because I learned so much from him. And that was a moment where he just absolutely teed it up for me.
That's amazing. All right, everyone, that's it for Bleacher Tweets for today. Subscribe, rate, and review to the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. And don't forget, Terry Francona tomorrow. Going to be good.
Don't forget, I'm telling you, it was a fun and a great interview. Terry is such a great storyteller and has such specific memories. My thanks today to Jim Leland, to Marley Rivera, to Taylor Schwenk. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening, and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.